Hi, everybody. My name is John Scott, and I am an alcoholic.
Amen.
And it's by the grace of God, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsorship. I haven't found it necessary to have a drink or any drugs since December 19th, 1982, and for that I'm awful grateful. And so is a bunch of other people. my mom still to this day, after some 22 years, every once in a while she calls, "Are you still going to the AA meetings? Boy, don't you quit doing that. Whatever they do, they are doing." Anyways. So I don't know why she felt like that. I was such a good boy. I'm here kind of to set the record straight from yesterday's hideous story that we heard earlier in the morning. I don't know. How would I do that? I was there, but you know how we are. I don't remember much. Most of my story is hearsay. I want to thank the committee for asking Cindy and I to be here. When I first got the invitation to come and visit with a treatment center, I wasn't all that excited, I have to admit. But I got to tell you something, boys and girls, this is something else. This is something else, it really is, and I am. I feel honored and privileged to be here. I'm tickled to death to meet all the M's. Jimmy M, Bobby M, Al M, and all the rest of the M's. And I want to tell Linda thanks a bunch for picking us up at the airport, making sure our doors are locked so we can't get out, feed me on a continuous basis. All we've done is talk and eat and talk and eat and talk and eat. And I want to thank Michelle for having the time and the patience with all my phone calls trying to figure out what's going on. And just a good bunch of people here. There really is a good bunch of people here. And there's a spirit here that I am just akin to, and that is this overwhelming desire to be of service. You know, most of us get here because we're not all there to begin with. And we finally show up at this opportunity that we had. And I didn't go to treatment. Whenever I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was sincerely beat all to pieces. I had been given a great gift. And I hope all the newer people here have been given that same gift. And it's a gift of desperation. I just absolutely did not know what to do. I had, in my own mind, you know, now this is the trouble with me. If you're listening to my story, you got to remember there's a couple of things that are going on. First off, I have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. That means that most of the things that I think about are not really real. And second off, my view of how things happen are probably not true. All the things that I felt probably have nothing to do with anything other than me and my insecurities. I can remember, you know, I thought that I was a fairly successful individual. I was raised on a ranch, a big ranch in Montana. We have a big farm and an agriculture operation that we do. I mean, we're talking about a pretty good size outfit. I used to jump in my helicopter and fly to work. I mean, this is kind of the operation that we had, and it was really a big outfit. I had a tendency to drink every once in a while. The first time I ever remember drinking was we were moving some cattle across the prairie, and it was hot, and there's no water for 100 miles in any direction. And some old boy come up with a pickup, and he had a cooler in the back of his pickup. Now, this is in the olden days, and there was no ice in the cooler. It's just, you know, he gave everybody a beer. And it was something to drink, and I can remember drinking it, and it just tasted terrible. I mean, it tasted like something that come from horses. I can remember, you know, just thinking, my goodness. It's like I'm never going to be able to drink this stuff, you know. But I practiced over the years, and I got to where I could do it pretty good. And I finally got. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was drinking really well. I had that down to fine art. My problem, I found out later, even though it felt like it was my problem, was this business of drinking. It really wasn't drinking. For me, whenever I finally got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I found out that my problem was sobriety. And how do you live life sober? Because I would quit every once in a while before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Quit forever. I mean, I can remember one time we had this after harvest party, and the idea was that you would get this great big old horse trough full of ice and throw, you know, hundreds of dollars worth of booze in there and let all the folks that was working for us at the time, you know, drink it, and we'd have this after harvest party. And now the only thing was that I had been drinking for several days. See, I'm the kind of guy who gets out there and gets with it. You know, I don't have one or two drinks. I have a tendency to have days and weeks. I'm the kind of guy that goes for bread on Thanksgiving Day, and I show up a few days before Christmas. I mean, I don't know how that happens. I just have a few beers with some of my friends. And, you know, she used to say, you know, if you just call and tell me where you're at. And I did that once. I mean, geez, you know, and you don't want to do that kind of stuff. And I can remember, you know, there's just a lot of times that I would come home and you know, you just kind of, you know, where were you? I don't know. I don't know where I was. Well, what happened? Well, I know one thing. I spent a lot of money, you know, and I think I had a good time. And that's just kind of how it went, you know. We had this after harvest party, and I had been doing one of those things. I'd been gone for 2 or 3 weeks, and I came back, and I, you know, I'm never ever going to do it again. This is it. I'm done. I'm through. I'm not going to do it. And I gave all the booze away to the guys and gals that were working for us at the time. And I, you know, I stayed sober then. I was going to stay sober forever. And that's the longest I can remember ever making it. That was 3 days. And on the third day, it dawned on me that those goofballs that worked for me didn't really deserve that booze that I gave to them. And so I went to their houses and demanded it back. And some of them would give it back and some of them wouldn't. But I can remember the ones that wouldn't give it back, I'd stay around and I'd make them give me a drink or two, and I figure at least I was getting some of it, you know. And so, I mean, this is kind of the goofy things that I used to do. I mean, you know, I don't have a terrible bad story. I mean, I didn't do terrible bad things. I didn't get thrown in prison. I got thrown in jail, you know, several times. But, you know, it's like, my drinking was like this. Today it's bad, but tomorrow's just going to be a little worse. I mean, at the end, that's the way it was. Now, when I started, it was just fantastic. You know, and like Cindy said, whenever I met Cindy, I was playing in a rock and roll band. And now, when I was playing in a rock and roll band, I know it's hard to believe, but when I was... We're broke down already. Is it still working? All right. You know, I forget what it was. Hi, I'm John, and I'm an alcoholic. What was that? I don't even remember. Rock and roll. Okay, all right. I was playing rock and roll, and I don't know. About that time, I just decided I didn't need to drink anymore, so I just did all the drugs that I possibly could. And I couldn't believe her. You know, our speaker last night was talking about shooting those drugs up and stuff, and I just could never figure out how they did it. But whenever I got around to it, it wasn't that hard at all. You know, it's just one of those things that just kind of come natural, you know. And I met Cindy, and we fell in lust, and we got to where we just could not stand to be without each other. And, of course, now, Cindy left some parts out, and I just want to kind of straighten you out on some of this stuff. And one of the things that she left out about how she got thrown in jail, she made it to jail before I did, you know. She had a tendency, her mouth, she would get to talking, and she was, I hate that story when she says she was only 12, you know, but she was only 12 when I first met her. She lied to me. She told me she's 18. And I don't want you to think I'm slow or anything, but I believed her. The police department didn't fall for it. And anyway, they said that they was going to throw me in jail for the rest of my life. And if we ever saw each other again, and I got out that afternoon and I went and saw her again, and to tell her that I can't see her again, you know, you know, I mean, I don't know how I think, you know, I don't know if you people are like this, but it's like, I think I'm above normal intelligence. But when you look at some of the things I did, it's like, how did I ever get that idea? You know, it's like, I'm just not all there most of the time, yet I think I'm batting on all cylinders, you know. And I find that, I guess whenever I had a drink of alcohol, it really made me think that I was better, or I was stronger, or I was more of whatever it is that I wanted to be. And that's why I loved to drink, because all of a sudden all those insecurities left me, and all those fears left me, and all the it was like I had the ability to imagine things how they should be whenever I was drinking. And people from time to time would say, "John, you just drink too much. You're gonna have to quit." And I could not believe it, even be talking like that. I mean, this stuff was the stuff that life was made of. You know, this is what made me whole, because I felt like all my life I wasn't whole. Whenever I was a kid and I was going to school, it was like junior high, and I can remember two older guys were walking behind me one day, and they said, "Look at him, he walks funny." And I thought, you know, I don't think I walk funny. And for the next 5 or 6 years, I never could walk right. It's like I just I couldn't dance, and I couldn't talk to people. But all of a sudden, one night, somebody gave me some booze, and I could walk, and I could talk, and I could dance. And if a girl come, I went up to a girl and asked her if she would dance, because it took everything I could do to ask a girl to dance. And I'd ask her to dance, and she'd say no. It's like, oh. I mean, it's like I'm done. I'm through. I'm not even going to try anymore. But I have a few drinks of alcohol, and I go up and ask that gal to dance, and she says no, and I just kind of feel sorry for her. You know what I mean? It's just like, okay. And I just go to the next one. It's no big deal. And that's what booze does for me. And people from time to time say, "John, you're doing it too much. You're going to have to slow down. It's not right." And I can't hear none of that. I don't want to hear none of that, because they don't know what's happening to me. When I drink, I feel whole. When I drink, I feel like I am a part of. And when I'm not drinking, I get weird, and they get weirder. And I can't stand being around myself, because I know I'm not what I'm supposed to be. And I don't know what I'm supposed to be, but I know I'm not it. You know what I mean? And so I finally, Cindy and I ended up getting married. I mean, we went with each other for a few years, and then we ended up getting married. And we started this family, and I went to work for my dad and my family on the ranch, and I decided I needed a career change. This rock and roll business wasn't paying off that well. And at that time, here's how my life went. The summer before we got married, I'm walking downtown Billings. I was wearing bell-bottom pants, a cape, and it was a nice cape. And I had long hair down to my shoulders, wearing beetle boots. I don't know, some people probably don't know what that is anymore. But anyway, I was walking down the street, and I don't know, people would, honk their horn and give me signals, and I just felt so lonely. I felt so out of place for some reason. And I decided I needed a career change, because I was going to marry her, and I needed to provide her with a living, so I decided to quit the drugs, and I'm going to go work on the ranch. Now, so I got my hair cut, and I turned trader, and I got my hair cut, and I went to the ranch, and from that point forward, all I did was pretty much drink. Now, it's funny today the cowboys have long hair and do dope, and the hippies, I guess they just drink. I don't know what they do, but, it's just like everything changes as things go on, and we moved out to the ranch, and for the next several years, I had bankers and lawyers take me to Chicago and stuff like that. And I can remember one time being on the 95th floor of the John Hancock Building in downtown Chicago. They was feeding us supper. And here I am with these bankers and lawyers and all sorts of successful business people. And within 40 minutes, I'm downstairs on the ground floor looking for lower companions. I mean, it's like my life is just great swings as I went through it, And it's like I just never quite got in step with the rest of the world. Over a period of time, Cindy and I got into this dance of trying to kill each other. It's basically where it got to. I mean, it got to where she didn't like me and I didn't like her much better. She's talking about, that deal with the shotgun. She kind of leaves out the part that what the trouble was is I got so goofy and so wrapped up into myself that I got to thinking, after a period of time, whenever I got to the place where we seemed to all get to, is that point of desperation, is that I got to a place where I had lost everything that was important to me inside. I had lost the ability to give you my word and be able to follow through. I had lost the ability to commit. I'd lost the ability to be responsible. I had no integrity. I mean, all the things that I really felt like were near and dear to me whenever I first started life. It seems like they just got stripped away. I knew better. I had good parents, and they taught me good principles to live by. And I just shunned them all for some reason. I got to a place where I couldn't do it. It's like I think when you live the life that we live, you get to a place where you just can't do it. And I can remember, you know, knowing that I was never going to amount to much, and I knew that I wasn't a good father, I wasn't a good husband, I dang sure wasn't a good businessman, I wasn't a good friend, I was a zero. And I knew that. And I got to thinking about suicide, and I would, you know, it ain't my fault, you know. And so I get to thinking, you know, it's really her fault. And what I need to do, because it's her fault, yeah, I'm going to have to kill myself because I'm worthless, but it's her fault. So it began to make sense that I needed to kill her too. And then she's out there beating on the side of my house with a, you know, and always in my face. And so that day I decided I was just going to, it was such a simple deal. I mean, she's talking about freezing me to death. My deal was I was just going to walk out there and say, well, these birds are circling around the house, and I went to shoot and tripped and fell and got her. You know, it's, you know, I don't know why. I don't know why I didn't freeze to death, and I don't know why I didn't get her. You know, I used to drive her around the ranch at night because she'd get lost in about 5 seconds. And when I kill you, I'm going to cut you up in little tiny pieces. And I'm put one of you over there, one over there. And it's like, just, you know, and the next day we'd just act like nothing happened, you know. Then I'd have to move her out because she's going nuts. And I'd move her out, and it'd be glad bags, you know, and back of my pickup and get out to her mom's house and just throw them out in the yard and drive off. And I had a guy who I sponsored years later, lived across the street, and he says, you guys created more entertainment for us that summer. He said, we could always tell which way he was going, because if he was coming in, it was always glad bags, and if he was going out, you'd always have a Samsonite, you know. And it's just like, we just lived that kind of, and we lived like that for a long time. I mean, it was, and of course, you know, I was so glad that I got sober before it affected the kids. You know, they were just, you know, we had one of them just be, you know, he'd just tip over, you know, you don't know what, you know, it's just like he'd just all of a sudden hold his breath and tip over, you know. We'd take him to the doctor trying to figure out what was wrong, and they said he's an epileptic and it was probably caused from stress living around mom and dad. And some of you M's know about that. It's so funny, when we sobered up, he quit doing that, you know. And I had a little girl that every time I'd walk into the room, she'd go get a daddy beer. And it's like she'd just, you know, it's like it was, you know, thinking about, at the time I thought it was cute, but thinking back, it's not cute at all. You know, and this is the way I was living when I, you know, and Cindy and I was getting divorced. I hated her. I couldn't stand her. You know, and the lawyer said, well, he says, with your track record, John, he says, I got to tell you, you get a divorce from her, she's going to keep the kids. Well, I hadn't even noticed I hardly had kids until that point, you know. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, she ain't going to get my kids, you know. And so I was just sick enough about that time I ended up finding myself in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that, now if you're new, you probably know what I'm talking about. And if you've been around, you dang sure know what I'm talking about. But I had the mind of a newcomer. You know, every 5 seconds it's like this, and then it's all of a sudden it's like that. Well, here my mind was, is that I thought maybe I needed to go to AA because I have this drinking problem. But on the other hand, you know, what I can do is, now, this is for people who are not sure whether or not they're coming to AA for the right reasons. This is one of the reasons that I was coming to AA. I can stay sober for a year, maybe a year and a half. And after that time, I'm going to go buy a bunch of drugs, put it in her purse. She's working at the bank. Call the cops and say, guess what? There's a big drug deal going down at the bank today. I just thought I might want to give you her name, you know. And then when they throw her in prison, I get to keep the kids, you know. Now, that's one of my newcomer ideas. And I stuck with it until they warped me in AA. But that lasted for a while. I can remember, you know, sitting there night after night with a gun stuck in my mouth, I was going to pull the trigger because, you know, life was absolutely not worth living. Now, why I never pulled the trigger, I have no idea. I mean, as goofy and jumpy as I was, it's amazing that didn't happen. I'd sit there and try to run trucks off the road and that kind of stuff. You know, it's like I'm going to kill myself somehow, but it just can't hurt, you know, and it just never happened. And I can remember one day a guy named Frank showing up at my house, and Frank was a guy that I got drunk with a lot. And he was a feed salesman, and he came in there. And it was kind of like Bill's story. I was so glad to see Frank because now I can have a few drinks. It was only noon, you know, and I was supposed to be running this feed lot at the time. Of course, I didn't show up to work much. And I had that's another thing. I always hired alcoholics instead of Al-Anons. You know, alcoholics are terrible workers, but Al-Anons always make you look bad. You know, because, you know, they're out there doing things, and, you know, it's... Anyway, I don't know what that had to do with anything, but today I love to work Al-Anons. At least you get the job done. And alcoholics are not too bad if they sober up. But anyway, I can remember Frank coming out to the house, and I was so tickled to see him. I said, come on, Frank, let's have a drink. He says, no, I'm not drinking today, John. I said, well, why not? He says, well, I'm just not drinking today. And so I'm an obnoxious kind of a drunk. If you don't want to play with me when I'm drinking, I'll play with you. And so Frank would try to leave, and I wouldn't let him leave. And I kept saying, Frank, you need to have a drink. You need to have a drink. And Frank wouldn't have a drink with me. And finally, he finally told me what it was that he was doing. He was going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And I thought, Frank, my God, haven't you overcorrected a little bit? I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous. You drink just like I do. And Frank goes, yeah, I know. And I said, well, Frank, maybe, you know, my life is upside down. Cindy and I are getting a divorce. Maybe what we ought to do is, maybe you ought to take me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, no, he says, I'm not going to do that. I said, well, why not, Frank? And he says, well, it's because Alcoholics Anonymous, for people who want to quit drinking, and you don't want to quit drinking, obviously, you're still drinking. He says, but I'll tell you what, in the morning, if you don't drink, he says, I'll take you to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can remember waking up that next morning going, my God, I can't believe what this booze is doing to me. I almost went to AA last night, you know. I didn't have to watch this. You know? So I had to die for about another 6 months. And it's just, like I was saying, the next day is just a little worse than yesterday. That's all it was for 6 months. Just the next day is a little worse than yesterday. And it just kept on going and kept on going. And finally, on December 18th, 1982, I woke up in the basement of a house that I couldn't recognize at first, and it dawned on me that I was over at a friend's house, and I was out of money. I'd been gone for, you know, about 3 or 4 weeks. I was at a point of desperation. I had that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization going on. It's like I just absolutely didn't know what to do. And the only thing that I could remember to do is go see Frank, because Frank, at least Frank had some kind of answer. As far as I knew, Frank had had a drink for at least 6-7 months. So I went to Frank's feed store, and I asked Frank if he wouldn't mind taking us to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, this is about 8:30 in the morning. This guy that I was with, him and I had already managed to buy a six-pack or two or three or four. And I would, well, whenever I'd do this, I'd get nervous, you know, and I'd have to have something to calm me down in the morning. So I can remember, you know, we was already drinking a little bit, and Frank was tickled to see us. He had these 20 questions, these AA 20 questions, you know, that nobody can pass unless you're an Al-Anon. And so he's got these 20 questions. He says, here, try this test and see if it works. Well, I cheated as much as I could and still flunked, you know, or passed, however you want to look at it. Because it says, like, if you miss 3, you're in trouble, and 4, you're just done for out of 20 questions. And shoot, I cheated as much as I could, and I think I got 18 wrong, you know. I can remember asking Frank, you know, would you take us to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? He said, no. Because already this morning you guys are drinking. Now he says, if you go ahead and drink all you want to the rest of the day, but tonight, when you get through drinking, don't drink no more, and I'll take you to your meeting tomorrow. So that sounded not too bad to me, because I was still pretty nervous coming down off this 3 or 4 week drunk of mine. And I can remember, you know, me and this other guy went to a keg bar. Keg bar is one of the, I got to liking the keg bar. It's one of those places where Cindy says, why are we here? And I says, well, it's because this is where all my friends are. And she looks around. I mean, there's all these losers there. I mean, you know, ex-bikers, ex-truckers, ex-losers. I mean, you know, you name it. And I fit right in. She couldn't believe that we'd go to those kind of places, because I'd always be at the Northern Hotel, which is where all the ranchers and farmers and businessmen would go. But I'd had a little problem at the Northern Hotel. I had a tendency to, the Northern Hotel had 2 stories up to the bathroom and 2 stories down to the bathroom. On the main floor where the bar was, there was no bathroom. Well, every once in a while, I'd have a problem. And instead of having to go up 2 floors or down 2 floors, I'd just go in their flower pot. And they had a tendency to dislike that. So anyway, I was at the keg bar that next day because they wasn't liking me too much over at the Northern, and I was sitting there with the 20 questions. Now, at 8:30 in the morning, I want you to know at the keg bar at 8:30 in the morning, nobody could pass the test. Because, so it become obvious to me, because I have this thing called the secret weapon that lives between my ears. And the secret weapon tells me things that aren't true, but I love to believe them anyway, because I love the liar. You give me an honest guy that'll tell me the truth, I don't want much to do with him. You give me a liar, I always love him. You know, I don't know how why that works, but that's the way it works for me. And I can remember sitting there going, you know, it's obvious to me, with a name like Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys are losing a lot of membership. And what you've done is you come up with this test that nobody can pass, and you get some loser like me that's having a bit of bad luck, and you're going to make me take the test, and it's going to be obvious that nobody is having bad times is going to be able to pass the test. And then you have to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and after about, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 months, you're going to have to end up getting a, you're going to have to pay the dues, you know, like $50 a month or something like that. You know, it's obvious, you know. So anyway, me and these guys took this test. And I always want to remember that last day that I was drinking, because it's, you know, you have these really good thoughts about how it was when you was drinking. And this is how it was the last day I drank. I sat over there in the corner of the bar and I cried because nobody had come in and visit me. Everybody else was over there and I was over here by myself, and I was so alone and so lonely and so just absolutely would love to talk to somebody. And you'd come over to talk to me, and then I'd want to fight you, you know. And then you'd leave, and then I'd cry because I was so lonely, you know. And that's kind of basically my last day of drinking, my wonderful last day of drinking. And I'd have to remember that. I got that next night, and Frank was going to meet me at a restaurant, and he had another guy that he was going to meet me with. And this guy's name was Richard. And Richard was, he was a guy who had a three-piece suit, and he smoked cigarettes just like this, and he stood up real straight because he had a bad back. He was just really nervous, and he had about 5 years of sobriety. And I walked into that restaurant, and I was sick. I was absolutely sick. I can remember just barely able to make it. And they were laughing and joking, and they bought themselves a steak and bought me a steak, and I told them I didn't want it, and they ate it anyway. It didn't matter. And Richard asked me this question, and I can remember. He says, "Do you feel like you're responsible for your own actions?" And I knew that this was an elite group of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I've been trying to get into it for over 6 months, you know. And I can remember saying, yeah, I do. And he says, "Good. Now maybe you'll start acting like it." And I don't know. I knew things. I knew that he'd been talking to Frank, and Frank had been talking to Cindy, and Cindy had been telling him all the, you know, giving me all the dirt, you know, giving him all the dirt about how I'd been living. But then he got to talking about things that Cindy didn't even know about. And he got to talking about how those feelings inside, those feelings of inadequacy, and that knowledge that you know that you're a loser and you're always going to be a loser, and that every morning getting up and swearing that you're never ever going to drink again, and by noon or even earlier you're drinking again every single day. And it's like how you would justify that next drink, you know. It's like, well, I just changed my mind, or I've been good for a little while, you know. There's all these things, and he knew about those things, and somehow I was beginning to get the connection. I was starting to feel that maybe somebody, maybe just by some dumb luck, I finally ran across some person in the world who knew about how I was feeling on the inside. And we went over to the meeting that night, and they were laughing and joking, and it was obvious to me that every one of them was not an alcoholic. They were counselors or something. That's what the $50 was for. They were paying each other, you know. And there's a few losers like me who are really real alcoholics, but most of them was, you know, because they were dressed well, and they were laughing and joking and playing and having a good time. There's another old boy over there. He was not happy. And I asked him, "How long have you been here?" And he says, "I've been sober for 2 weeks." And by God, he looked like it too. You know, there was people in that group that claimed that they'd been sober for 20, 25, 30 years. And I go, why? You know, why would you do that to yourself? You know, but this little boy that had 2 weeks, I'm going, yeah, I knew he had to. He had to have had 2 weeks because he did not look happy. But yet still he gave me hope, because at least he could do it for 2 weeks, and maybe I can. And they told me that first night that I needed a sponsor, and before I could even open my mouth, this guy named Johnny says, "I will be your sponsor." And he took me to his house. And in Billings, the bar is closed at 2 o'clock, and at 2:01, he says, "It's time for you to go home now." And he kicked me out, and I went home, and he called me the next morning and says, "It's time for you to come into town." Because at that time, I was living, you know, some 30 miles out of town. And I got in there, and he began to talk to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And a few hours later, two guys from the group showed up, and they took me for a couple hours. And two guys from the group showed up, and they took me for a few more hours. And then it was time for a meeting. And then after the meeting, Johnny would take me to his house. And that's what they did. They gave me a concoction of K-Real syrup, honey, and orange juice, and a handful of vitamins. We don't know what they are. And just put it in a blender. He says, "Hey, here, drink this. It'll make you feel better." And it didn't make me feel better, but it tasted so bad, I just kept telling him, I'm better, so don't, you know. And to this day, I'm not too excited about orange juice. And I can remember going to those meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there is something that happened to me in those early days as I began to have a little hope. And that was something that had been out of my life for quite some time, because I had got to a point of desperation, and I just felt like there was nothing that was going to help me. I've been to some doctors, I've been to preachers, I've been to jail. I mean, I've gone every place that I could think of going. And my folks told me that there's a little bit of alcoholism in our family, and I need to really watch this booze. And before I even knew how to watch it, it was already way out of control. And I found myself going to these meetings, and I found myself getting better. Sometimes the trouble with Alcoholics Anonymous is it just works too well. And the next thing you know, I'm going to meetings and I'm feeling better. And this guy that was my sponsor, this Johnny, after about 45 days, he had 7 years of sobriety, and he got mad at his sponsor, and he got mad at his group, and he got drunk. You know? And I thought, well, you know, at least now I get to pick my own sponsor, you know. And there's this little blonde I've been watching, and she was just as cute. And I can remember walking across the floor that day, and Richard intercepted me and says, "Well, Johnny," says, I hear that Johnny's gone out." And I says, "Yeah, that's what I hear." And he says, "Well," he says, "you're going to be needing a sponsor." And I says, "Yeah." And he says, "I'm going to be your sponsor." And I said, "Well, Richard, I don't really know if I want you to be." "Oh," he says, "I didn't ask you whether or not you wanted me to be your sponsor." He says, "I'm going to be your sponsor." And he was like that. He always knew what I needed, you know. And shortly after, Richard was a used car salesman, and shortly after that, he sold me a diesel car, because he said it's what I wanted. It was not what Cindy wanted, and she was not happy about that. She was not happy about anything during that period of time. And I can remember, ended up getting this diesel car from Richard. And I always like to talk a little bit about my home group, those guys. And I want you to, because sometimes I forget to say this, they saved my life. They literally saved my life. But this is a newcomer's perception of my home group whenever I first got there. There's some really goofy people there. And one of the goofy people was, Cindy was talking about her last night, or yesterday, her name was Millie. And Millie was this, she was like a grandmother, you know, and it's like she's just as sweet as could be, and she'd always sat in her same chair. She never said a lot, but she sat in her same chair. And there was something about her being in that chair that just made the rest of us calm down a little bit, it seems like. And she'd sit there and she'd say the dumbest thing. She'd say, "God, John, look at all the miracles." And I couldn't see what she was talking about. I didn't see no miracles, you know. And she'd sit here and she'd sit next to me, and we'll look at the miracles. And I'm sitting there looking at all these goofballs. There's not a miracle in the crowd, you know. Then there's this other goofy old woman in there, and her name was Margaret. And if you called her Margaret and you asked Margaret, you know, to talk, she would say the same thing just over and over again. She'd say, "Hi, my name is Margaret, and I'm an alcoholic. And them that go to meetings stay sober, and them that don't. Thank you." What a lame, I mean, just a lame message, you know. And if you call on her 6 months from now, she'd go, "Hi, my name is Margaret, and I'm an alcoholic, and them that go to meetings stay sober, and them that don't. No, I mean, no growth or nothing, you know. And, I mean, I looked at the steps on the wall, and I thought, you know, maybe 3 months at the most. You know, I mean, there's some really sick old guys in that group that have been there for 20, 25 years. They're still reading the first 164 pages out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They were retarded, you know. Some of these guys this guy named Nick. Nick was a little guy, stood about that tall. He'd been a counselor down in Denver. He had this high little shrill voice, you know. And me and Frank was discussing our divorce one time, and we was kind of, and he come up behind us and there's a couch there, and he was like, well, poor me, poor me, poor me, another drink. He'd say stuff like that all the time. His deal was that if you wasn't there for 6 months to a year, there was no reason at all for him to remember a visitor's name, you know, because you're just passing through. You're just a visitor. And he'd make a point of saying that about every other night. He probably said it once, but, you know, for, you know, I'm a sensitive newcomer. You got to understand. There's another guy in our group. His name is Rotten Ralph. Rotten Ralph was an attorney. He earned the name. He didn't come by it natural. He earned it, you know, and the guy would sit there and he would, his favorite deal was he'd always carry his dollar for the basket in his pocket. And he would sit there and say, if you got called on before Ralph did and you made the mistake of saying anything, if you were there less than 6 months or more than less than 6 months, he'd sit there and just harangue you, you know, because his deal was obviously you don't know how to stay sober. The only thing you know is how to stay drunk. And he says you shouldn't even be talking in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he'd just hammer on the guy for talking. And then he'd, at the very end, he'd pull out a dollar and say, now, if I have pissed you off, let me buy you your first drink. You know, and, I mean, that's no way to treat a new guy. I know that. You guys do too. I mean, it's a simple deal. You've got to be kind and loving. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. We're tolerant towards all. You know, and then there's this other guy named Gerald, and Gerald was a guy who, he didn't like my attitude, and I don't know what was wrong with him. You know, but he thought I had a sorry attitude. He'd ask me how I was doing, and I told him I hated him, God, and AA, and everything else, and especially her. And he'd say, John, he says, we're going to quit that. He says, I've been sober for about maybe 3 months at this time. He says, John, we're going to quit that. He says, from now on, John, when I come to you and I ask you how you're doing, you're going to answer me, and you're going to answer me in this way. You're going to go, why, Gerald, I'm getting better in every way, every day. Thank you very much. Got me lying now. Honesty program. Got me lying. And I just can't believe these people. I mean, it just doesn't, you know, I thought at first when I first started going, they were so kind and loving. Now in a few weeks, they'd turn black on me. And it's like, I can't, it's like, what's the deal here, you know? And I thought, you know, I know that none of you guys have ever done this, but I got to thinking, you know, I'm going to get this old timer, this Nick. I'm going to get him. I'm going to get him where he remembers my stinking name. And I remember going to Nick and saying, Nick, you got a few minutes? You know, it's after a meeting. There's about 8 or 10 people around there still talking and stuff. And Nick sits down on the couch and says, sure, kid. And so I sit down and start telling him about how crazy my wife was. He jumps up and he says, I don't hear about that crap, kid. He says, I want you to know one thing. You're an alcoholic. He says, now what the hell are you going to do about it? And I thought, you know, this public humiliation, I can't hardly stand. And I can remember looking around and all these people looking at us, you know, probably one. But at the time, they was all looking at us. And I jumped up and I started to leave. And about that time, you know, Nick was a small, crippled guy. And he gets up and he pushes me up against the wall. And he says, all right. He says, you're wasting their time, you're wasting my time, and you're damn sure wasting your time. Why don't you just go get drunk because that's what you're trying to do? He says, you're not sincere, you're not honest about what's going on here, you're just screwing with us. Now just go get drunk. And out of nowhere comes Ralph right over the top of his shoulder. Let me buy your first drink, let me buy your first drink. You know. I jumped in that. I pushed them guys out of the way and I went out in that parking lot, his old gravel parking lot, you know, and I'm going to spin gravel all over this place and I'm going to get the hell out of here. And I got in that car and I turned it on and it's a diesel. I rolled out of there, you know, and I'm on my way home and I'm beating on the dash and I'm honking the horn and I'm yelling and screaming at the top of my lungs. It's like, I don't want you to think I was immature at the time, but it's just like, just crazy because this is sobriety and I can't stand it. I hate this crap, you know. It's like, what am I doing with my life? You know, it's just listening to a bunch of used car salesmen and the has-beens and losers and ain't none of them hardly hold a job, you know. Of course, they always working, you know, but, you know, just, there's always crazy about everybody working. You know, you gotta be a part of society. You gotta work. You gotta vote. You gotta do all that kind of stuff. These goofy people. And I can remember just about halfway home. It's like somebody just hit me up alongside the head. So you're an alcoholic. Now what are you gonna do about it? And from that point forward, things begin to change for some reason. And I can remember that next night I was never gonna go back again. And I got in the car, my diesel car, And I started going towards town, and I thought, you know, geez, I hate doing this. I hate doing this because, you know, I kind of got ran out of the group last night. But I felt like that's the only place I could go. It's like those people somehow knew what was going on inside of me, deep down inside of me. And I can remember, you know, geez, I hate doing this. I got to see Gerald, you know, tell him, hey, Gerald, I'm getting better in every way, every day, you know. And it just dawned on me, you know, I think I am. I think I might be. And so it wasn't so bad when I had to give Nick back, or Ralph back his dollar, you know. I was like, here, Ralph, I'm sorry, you know, I use it on somebody else next week. And it's like slowly I begin to kind of come out of myself, if you know what I mean. And I begin to surrender is what it was. And I can remember Richard shortly after that asking me how I was getting along with her. Well, he knows. I mean, he's been talking to Frank. Frank's been talking to her. I know that. And I told him, well, I'm getting a divorce. He says, now, wait a minute. I want to make sure I understand this. You're the one who's getting a divorce? And I says, yeah, I'm getting a divorce. He said, well, you quit that right now. I said, you don't understand. She's a crazy woman. Been trying to kill me. And he says, that's all right. Anybody living with you for 13 years got to be plumb out of her mind. Don't worry about that. And he says, what we're going to do, he says, you don't know how to have a relationship. And you may or may not get a divorce, but we're not going to rush into anything too fast here. It usually takes a year before we can do anything. In your case, it might be a year and a half. And he says, what we're going to do is we're going to start practicing on her as to how to have a relationship. He says, so what I want you to start doing is I want you to start telling her that you love her. Now here they're making me lie again, because I don't love her. I don't even like her. And he says, it doesn't matter. This is what I want you to do. He says, I want you to go tell her you love her, but she knows and I know and you know that you're a liar. So that's not enough for a guy like you who's a liar. He says, you're going to have to show her you love her. And the way you, and my ears went up, you know, I was getting, because it had been a long time since I've been in the big bed. And he says, no, that's not what we're talking about. That's not what we're talking about. He says, what you get to do is you get to go home and you get to clean up the dishes. You get to vacuum the floor. You get to treat her with kindness and respect first, because that's what you want in your life. And in order to get kindness and respect and dignity in your life, you have to give it first to somebody else. And I had a problem with that. Why me first? And he says, because you don't know, you wouldn't recognize it if somebody was kind to you. He says, so you have to start doing it so you begin to understand what it is that we're trying to teach you. And he says, you're going to go home and you're going to tell her that you love her and you're going to treat her like that. And I said, I don't think I want to do that. And he says, I'm going to tell you something else, and this is the carrot that I'm going to give you. If you do it and you do it right, it will drive her crazy. Oh, all right, I'll try that. And he was right. It drove her crazy. By that time, I was working on this little inventory that he'd asked me to do, and she'd come up to me, you're a dirty, rotten SOB, and here's why. And she'd have a little list, you know, in her head, and I'd pull out the paper and say, yeah, well, you missed a few things here. And I'd get to read, and she'd just... And I'd go, yes! And you know, it's an amazing thing what happened to her. She wouldn't go to Al-Anon. Every once in a while, though, she'd go to an AA meeting, and she only went to a few, and geez, she got a lot better fast. You know, it's amazing what's happening to her. You know, she was getting a little better. You know, then my sponsor started talking to me about the allergy. You know, he would read to me the doctor's opinion out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He talked about the allergy coupled with the mental obsession that the Dr. Silkworth talks about. And he says, we have this allergy that when we take a drink of alcohol, it just simply tastes like more. And then we have this mental obsession that the minute we quit drinking, all we can seem to think about is drinking more. And he says, and that's kind of what the problem is with us alcoholics, at least as described in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I have an allergy. I have allergies to apples, bananas, cherries, and avocados. And when I take a bite of an apple, my face swells shut, my chest swells shut, and I can't breathe. And I went to the doctor, and I bet the newest person in this room can tell me exactly what the doctor said. He said, don't do that. And you know, it was no big deal for me not to do that. I just didn't do that. But there's a connection that's missing between my allergy to apples and my allergy to alcohol, and that is that there's mental obsession is not there. I have never had a miserable damn day. got in my car, drove over to the grocery store, and decided to buy 6 apples. I'm going to put 1 apple in the trunk because I'm going to need it later, 1 in the glove compartment. I'm going to eat 1 on the way home, and by God, when I get there, I'm going to eat 1 in front of her, too. Never crossed my mind. I've never been sitting there, you know, at a very nice restaurant, and I look over there, and there's that couple, and they're having fruit salad. And I've never cheered up over that one. But I tell you what, they'll have wine over there, and I'll be looking at that, and I'll go, my God, they're having wine over there. You know, and then I go, why me? Why can't I have, you know, just that goofy stuff that we have. You know, so there's a little missing ingredient. That is that there, it's like there's a little man in the back of my head that's got a little time. He's got a little timer set there. And he's sitting back there, and after a period of time, he's going, now, John, now that you've been sober for so long, you know, you probably could get by without, you know, going to so many meetings. You could probably back off a little bit. Now, John, now that you know what you know about alcoholism, you could probably get by with that, you know. And it doesn't happen with apples. I never think that way with apples. I go, apples, I'm going to swell up. I don't think I'll do that. Booze, it's a totally different thing. So the mental obsession is the part that's missing between the two of them. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous deals with, is that goofiness that we have prior to taking the first drink. That insane thinking, that thought process that we have about, you know, maybe this time it's going to be different. And that's why I'm like a fighter. We're all like fighters. We're like prize fighters. We know that there's a fight coming, but we're not like prize fighters because we don't know what the day is. So we have to stay in fit spiritual shape in order to be able to fight that battle that we're all going to have to fight. It's coming. You know it's coming. I know it's coming. It's going to happen. And it comes, for us, it comes in the weirdest ways. You know, I mean, it's like the wine. I mean, who cares? I hate wine. I never even drink wine when I was drinking. You know, my deal is to keep them coming 2 at a time, and they better be whiskey. You know, I just like whiskey. I like whiskey and beer. I like whiskey and beer and acid. I like whiskey, beer, acid, speed, coke. You know, I mean, it's, you know, whatever's handy. I'm just a pig. And so I find myself at going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, sponsoring people, doing what I'm supposed to be doing, kinda. You know, I'm kinda in AA, if you know what I mean. I'm kinda doing the deal. And after 4 years of sobriety, my wife still hates me, my kids are still scared to death of me, I'm in bankruptcy, I'm doing real well by myself, and my sponsor has left. I'm using the group as a sponsor. Now, that's a great way to prevent suicide on the installment plan if you want to, because there's always somebody in your home group that is sick enough that will agree with whatever your goopy idea is. And so I'm sitting there having these new guys tell me how I can do what I can't do and believing it, because I love the liar. I just love to believe the lie. And I finally begin to understand that I wasn't doing too well. You know, this is what amazes me. I can live with me and not know a thing about me. You know, I have to, you know, if somebody asks me how I'm doing, wait, give me about 6 months and I'll tell you how I'm doing today. Because I don't know. It's like I'm disconnected. I've always been disconnected. And that's why I need people in my life. I need a sponsor in my life. I need somebody who can say, John, you're thinking weird again. And, oh, okay, I got it. You know, it's like, it's not that I don't agree with him. It's just like, I don't even know it. I'm missing a part. You know, I'm like Joe and Charlie says, I'm not whole. My pie is not whole. I'm missing an ingredient. There's something that's gone when it comes to me and my thinking. And it's okay to be crazy as long as you know it. Not knowing it, it's just terrible. You know, you do goofy things and you have no boundaries. And what happens to me when I have a sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous, I begin to have some boundaries. I begin to be able to live life to the fullest within the boundaries of how that could be done. And then without the sponsorship, without the home group, that doesn't exist for a guy like me. And so I get to do these things. It's not like I have to do these things. I got interested in long-term sobriety somewhere along the line, and I want to do what those old guys in AA have done. I want to be a member, an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous years from now, you know, provided I'm still alive. I want to be an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing years from now. I was 11 years sober. My sister had this store, and it was going like that. It was in bad shape. And my family asked me if I'd take it for a minute. And when I got a hold of it, it went like that, just straight down. I mean, it was like, it was kind of going broke before, and now we don't even have to worry about kind of. It's gone broke. And my sister was really depressed, and she's not one of us. She was really depressed, and she ended up, I called her one morning, and I asked her, I said, you know, Maggie, would you like to go out to eat lunch today? If you would, I'd come over and pick you up. She says, yeah, I would. That'd be nice. I'd like that. I was sponsoring a guy at the time. He was very, very wealthy. He wintered down in Central America, a place he had down there. And he'd been sober for 5 years, and now he's been drunk for 5 years, and now he's been sober for about 5 seconds, and I've been his sponsor. And he was a hell of a salesman, just a really good, I mean, that's how he made his living. And he called me up to fire me that day because I was overcorrecting. I was asking him to go to 4 meetings a week because that's what I do. And, you know, I got 2 required meetings. I got 2 of the meetings that I go to. I got a sponsor that I call, and I call him on time when I'm supposed to call him, and I do the things that I'm asked to do. And that's the only thing I was asking him to do. And he got to explaining to me how I was overcorrecting and we really didn't need to do this stuff. Of course, he's only got a few seconds of sobriety, you know. Here goes the secret weapon, and I start listening to this guy. And all of a sudden, he starts making sense. So I hung up the phone, this guy is hitting it. You know, he has reached in there and grabbed some real thought behind what he was saying. And I can remember picking my sister up, who hadn't even smiled in weeks or months, and I driving along there, and I said, Maggie, you know, I've been thinking. I think I probably overcorrected with this AA thing a little bit. You know, and the truth of the matter is, Cindy and I was having some serious problems there before I got here, and now that those things have been cleared up and we're really getting along pretty well, the kids are all right. My business is doing well. Yours sucks, but mine's doing well. And I think that, you know, I probably don't need to go to that many meetings. And she got to laughing. So hard, she says, take me to a filling station. So I went to the filling station. She ran into the bathroom, come back out, still laughing. I said, Maggie, what's so damn funny? And she says, you are crazy, aren't you? And I said, what are you talking about? She says, you're crazy as a loon. You're not kidding. You're absolutely out of your tree. Don't you remember the last 3 years that you drank? You never drew a sober breath in that entire period of time. It's like somebody just splashed cold water in it. Okay, I guess I'll go to a meeting tonight. I mean, that's how goofy I am. You know, it's like, all right, I'll do what it is that I need to do. I asked a guy one time, his name was Old Larry, why is it that I have to go to meetings 4 times a week when these people that go to church only go once a week? He says, it's really simple, John. Their life doesn't depend on it. Ours does. You know, and he says, you're coming in here to save your ass. And he says, what you're going to find out one of these days is that your soul's attached to it and you're going to get them both saved. And that's basically what's happened to me. It's amazing how we are, you know. We come in here and we get this good stuff, and then all of a sudden we think, well, this ain't quite it. You know, I'm leaving a piece on the table someplace, you know. And what that is that insanity that I lived with for so many years. I am so thankful that I'm an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because if I don't do this, I get weirder. I just get weird, you know, and it's okay to get weird if that's what you want to do, but I don't want to do that no more. I don't want to drink no more. I don't want to screw up my life no more. I want to try to be a good friend to good people. And I guarantee you there's a lot of good people right here in this room tonight. There's absolutely, or this morning, it shows you where I'm at. So anyway, you know, I got to tell you something. About, 3 months ago, we got a daughter who Cindy was talking about, has got 14 years of sobriety. And her husband's got 14 years too. He's older than that. He's got 17, yeah. And they've been married for quite a few years now, and I've been wondering if they're ever going to have a kid, a baby. And they said the other day that they were. Now, I got all excited about that. I got to tell you, it is important to me, and I hope it's important to you, to keep Alcoholics Anonymous Alcoholics Anonymous, because it is vital for people like us. Other people who come to AA who may or may not be alcoholic, I don't know about those guys, but I know an alcoholic of my type, of the hopeless variety, of the goofiness that I possess. You know, I need what we have here. I need to be an active member of a group of people who are committed to each other's well-being. I need to have people who are interested in keeping the 12 traditions whole. And I'm interested in people who are interested in carrying the message of the 12 steps. You know, today I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable without you people. Today I need a power greater than myself that it can restore me to sanity. Today I need to turn my will and life over the care of God as I understand Him. That's what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It moves with me as I move through time. You know, those spiritual experiences and spiritual awakenings that they talk about that happens with us, and it's happened to me several times, those are great, but they're like Christmas. You know, you go along and you have Christmas. And Christmas is fantastic, and you tear open the presents, and it's all new, and it's all shiny, and it's all bright. But by New Year's, who remembers Christmas? And that's the same thing that happens to my spiritual experiences and spiritual awakenings. I have to continue to revive them over and over again. And if Alcoholics Anonymous is beginning to, and this is for the older folks, but if Alcoholics Anonymous is kind of getting boring to you, and it's not like it used to be in the good old days, I got a suggestion to you. Go find a new guy or a new gal and work with that new guy or that new gal, and I'll guarantee you what, when the light comes on, it's Christmas. When the light comes on, something happens in here, you see. When the light comes on, all of a sudden I begin to understand what the deal is. I don't do this for them. I do this for me. This is a selfish program, they said, when I first got here. And I thought, you know, it's like all these little quirky sayings you got in AA, you know, like, keep coming back one day at a time, whatever it says. Let go of it. What is it? Let go. Let God. How do you do that? You know, it's like, I don't know how to do that. But what I do is I hang around these old guys and I begin to understand that I don't understand. I begin to understand that I do not understand. I don't understand my disease. I don't understand God. I don't understand human nature. And what happens to me, the longer I'm here with you people, the more I begin to understand those things. So I want Alcoholics Anonymous to be the way it was for me whenever I got here. I don't think we need to change anything. I think we're doing just fine. It works for the people that want it to work, and it doesn't work for the people who don't. I mean, people who want to do Alcoholics Anonymous do certain things. I mean, it's obvious. And people who don't want Alcoholics Anonymous don't do certain things. You know, it doesn't mean that you can't do it later. I know a lot of folks that have come back later, and it's like, oh, man, good members, really good members of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I want to thank everybody for allowing me to show up here and just be a part of it. This has been an absolutely fantastic experience. We don't, you know, we get to do a little bit of this, and it isn't often that we get to feel so warmly welcomed as we have here. And it's just a fantastic experience, and I am so richly blessed to be a part of this thing. I really am. I got to tell you a couple of things. First off, I think that there's a lot of miracles in this room tonight. And then another thing that I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous a long, long time ago that certainly makes a lot of sense to me, and that is them that go to meetings stay sober, and them that don't. Thanks.